Hey, it's Canzano. I appreciate you listening to the podcast. Make sure you subscribe and give us some feedback. Also, the Bald-Faced Truth podcast, it's brought to you by Shoe Mill, my favorite shoe store with locations in Portland and Salem and online at shoemill.com. Shoe Mill, where we put the world at your feet.
Initialize sequence.
Welcome to the Baldcast, a production of John Canzano's Bald-Faced Truth. BFFT. Live from the home studios presented by High Caliber Millwrights, here's John Canzano with the Bald-Faced Truth.
We'll talk about Bill Walton's movie list. Heavy with nonfiction, heavy with documentaries, of course. It's nonfiction. A lot of music, some groovy stuff, and a surprising entry on Bill Walton's movie list. Movie I never would have thought he had on there. Our next guest, highly successful women's basketball coach. Final Four in his back pocket, Elite Eights, Sweet 16s, that's just what he does. Scott Ruick, Oregon State women's basketball coach, is joining us now. If I asked you for your movie list, what immediately pops into your mind as, hey, these would be on there definitely?
Well, A Few Good Men, I love. Total rewatchability. Yep. Gladiator is the one that I probably say the most. Lately, The Greatest Showman is up there for me. It has three scenes in it that I can just keep watching because of the emotions involved. Liar, Liar makes me laugh every time I watch it.
Yeah.
Those are kind of my go-tos. They're on my phone. I pull them out, you know, anytime I'm traveling. And so not much recently.
Tell me about Greatest Showman, because that is also a favorite in our household. I love that movie. Give me those scenes. Like, what's one of the scenes that really brings something out in you?
Well, the whole story of having a mission and a passion in life, and then also having a family. And the scene where they're on the roof, he gets home after he gets laid off from work early in the movie, and he says, you know, this isn't the life I promised you, to his wife, as the girls are running around on the rooftop at night. And he says, where is the magic? I promised you magic. And she looked at the girls and said, well, what do you call that over there? Gets me every time. When he brings the incredible singer over from Europe to perform, and, you know, allegedly he's never heard her sing, and he doesn't exactly know how it's going to go, but everything's riding on this moment, and she absolutely crushes it. And, you know, as a coach, you're building to these moments, and you have no clue exactly how things are going to go. And then when they go better than you expect, just the incredible feeling as you're looking up and seeing people going absolutely nuts and having, you know, a more incredible time than you even imagined, and everything comes together perfectly, has reminded me of a few moments in my career that were significant. And then at the end, the last scene after, you know, he's lost everything, the place burnt down, and he's sitting at the bar, and it basically says, you know, to focus on what truly matters. And that's a bit of what we're doing right now, I think, you know. Yep. But he sits there and he just has a perspective change on, I've been chasing these dreams that are someone else's, and instead of realizing what I truly value the most. And he gets down to that eventually. And, you know, that hits home for me a lot, because this world is pretty crazy and can consume you if you're not disciplined within it, to focus on those things that matter most, which are relationships, and especially with those closest to you.
There's a quote in the movie where he says, men suffer more from imagining too little than too much. And I have to think, as I was watching that movie, I also felt like, you know, there's an entrepreneur in him. There is an entrepreneurial spirit in every coach. You're building something. You're constructing a team, a roster, a locker room. You have an image in your mind, like P.T. Barnum, of what you want this circus to be like before anyone can actually see it.
The vision. You're creating the vision that you've been blessed with in your mind, and you're finding people that you want to align with. And then, you know, you're working so hard to the point where you're sacrificing for that vision. And then, you know, there's dangers in that, and then there's massive successes in that as well. And if it's noble, you know, then usually things align. And yeah, it's very much that way.
Over the weekend, I wrote a column about taking a walk with my three daughters, and I had I felt bad because I had not yet asked them, how are you guys doing? And we forget that kids pick things up. Kids have different stresses and different anxieties about what's going on in the world. And it was interesting to me to hear the three-year-old, as we crossed the street, go, hey, we don't want to get coronavirus. Like, we're moving away from a neighbor that was washing his car. And what conversations have you had with your kids?
Yeah, we've been together so much. And, you know, like I think a lot of people are saying is, you know, I hate that people are suffering. I mean, this is unlike anything any of us have experienced. And yet our role is to find the silver lining and to find the positives and to continue to produce in some way. And whether it's being creative or what can you do? Well, you can pour into relationships and communicate. And that has been the number one takeaway for me is this quality time with my family, especially our youngest. You know, our youngest is 8. You know, there hasn't been a lot of fear coming from them. I haven't sensed that. I've sensed disappointment in the girls. You know, our oldest is Cole. You know, he's 16. And then we have 13-year-old Kate, a 7th grader, and then Macy, the little one. And Kate and Macy are missing their friends. I mean, they're very much social beings and love to have fun with their friends, which obviously is not an option at the moment. And so they've had a great time together. You know, Kate can jump on FaceTime and interact with her friends that way. Obviously it's different. And then, you know, Cole's in relative heaven because the golf courses down here are still open. He golfs during the day, does school at night. And so life is good for Cole. However, I've been waiting for the moment to kind of sink in where, you know, the fact is he doesn't get to compete for state this year in golf. And I'm struggling with that. That's hard as a parent. I'm like, man, he's going to look back someday and say, I didn't get that season. I didn't get that year. And so our conversations have been, positive. We've looked for the positives in this whole situation. And we've lived there, and Carrie and I have both been listening and for those things that, we can help them through when they do struggle. Today, our youngest had a Zoom call with her second grade class for the first time. And I actually just talked to her about it right before we got on here. And she said it was cool. She said once a week is going to be about enough, you know, for that. And it was neat to see everybody. But so, you know, we're doing well. And I think Carrie, you know, has done a really good job at home, just, you know, keeping them busy and making our days productive. And so, yeah, it's been a fascinating time.
2016, you go to the Final Four, you mix it up with UConn. You've been Sweet 16, Elite Eight, Sweet 16 since then. Women's college basketball is getting more exposure. You're on television more. ESPN's paying attention. We're talking about it. I think it really, you have been part of that acceleration for this sport. What do you think's happened maybe to the top 15 or 20 teams in the country?
Yeah, it's an interesting time because I agree with you. I think the Pac-12 network was big for us in that regard. I think the exposure caused athletic departments to pay attention maybe at a higher level. This league has grown incredibly. We've worked hard off the West Coast, engaging ESPN and working on our relationship so they get to know us. And those collective things have helped us keep great players on the West Coast. Instead of leaving, they've stayed a majority anyway. And then we've obviously been able to recruit from around the world to the West Coast. And our conference now, you know, it's clearly seen this past year anyway as the best in the country, and everybody was saying it, including those people that were a bit apprehensive, you know. So I think it's just step by step, chipping away, and then doing the best we can with each of those opportunities once we've competed on a national stage, whether it's in the tournament or the preseason. It's an exciting brand of basketball. I think there is more attention being paid to women's sports in general, which has helped us, no doubt. And I think, you know, the football guy that I've always said is my target audience. I love to get the guy who never gave women's sports a chance. I love to win that person and open their eyes, you know, that these are incredible athletes. Gender has nothing to do with it. This is great sport. And if you give it a chance, you'll love it. And once you get to know them, you'll love it even more. And that's happened, you know. And so I think exposure has just increased, which has increased acceptance and respect.
When you're recruiting, because you're right about the Pac-12 network, like, you know, we will bellyache about it for football or the revenue that it maybe doesn't generate. But you're right, for sports like women's college basketball, you can walk into a living room and you can say you're going to be on TV and you're going to be on TV a lot. How much does that help in recruiting a female college athlete?
It's helped a ton. I mean, it's changed everything. I mean, when I first got here, our first 3 years, I believe we had one game on TV each year, one. And now this year we had every single game on our Pac-12 schedule. I think we had 4 or 5 on TV in the preseason, including our USA game with the Olympic team. And so the exposure is completely different. You know, certainly, you know, people have discussed limitations of the network at the moment. Those are still hurdles that we have. Well, obviously, well documented. And so for East Coast, you know, there's still a little bit of work to do, of course. However, the fact that we can say you can find it anywhere in the world and you can, you know, find a way to watch our games has opened doors for us from much further away than before. And so it's been a complete game changer for our sport.
Scott Ruick with us, Oregon State women's basketball coach. You got a transfer portal, and in some respects, I think it's good for athletes. In other respects, we are watching players around the country, regardless of sport, jump around. Destiny Slocum, one of your very good players, jumps into the portal, says she's leaving. How involved are you in having that discussion with her prior to her doing that? And what do you make of that as a coach who's watching sort of the landscape shift as you're part of it?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's in our sport, there's 440-ish students right now in the transfer portal in Division I, women's basketball. And so that's, I don't know if it's the biggest number ever, but I'm assuming it's close. And so, you know, you look at the trends in men's basketball, and then you look at, is our sport trending that direction? And usually they stay somewhat together in a way. You know, I'm a huge fan of the four-year process. I think everyone knows that. Transfer is not something that's typical to or from Oregon State in many ways, because I believe in that process so much, you know. And so the fact is, though, that that's not always reality. And, you know, the reality of the situation is we're dealing with, you know, people that have goals and dreams, and we are a vessel for them to achieve those dreams. And we do our best to help everyone associated with us. And so with Destiny, when she came to me, I can't say that I saw it coming, because I didn't, but I understand it, you know. And she came and talked to me. We had several talks, you know, and her purpose is just to find the best thing for her in aligning and setting herself up as she enters her last year, you know. And there's a curiosity there. We didn't burn the bridge. I don't burn the bridge. And so, you know, if she wanted to come back, that would be something that's available to her. And so, but she wanted to go down that road, you know, to see what's out there for her. And I said, I get it. I completely understand it. We love her and we support her, you know, and we want her to have the best career possible in every way. And so if that means going somewhere else, then that's what it means, you know. And so if it means coming back here, then that's what it means. And of course, that's what we would love, because we care about her and we'd love to finish this race with her. And so, but anyway, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, time in that, you know, there's the possibility of the immediate eligibility transfer rule could pass coming up fairly soon. It's obviously a big discussion that would be a game changer in all of college athletics. And so, yeah, it's different times. And I think we just all need to continue to evolve with them and do what we do within those, whatever the rules are.
It's tricky, too, because, you know, I've got a daughter that played club volleyball, and I saw as she grew up at age 11, 12, 13, 14, I saw kids that jumped clubs because they weren't playing or maybe the coach wasn't telling them what they wanted to hear. And I was conflicted about it because, you know, we've seen this infect the men's game, and I don't think it's good for the men's game. At the same time, I want to advocate for student athletes, regardless of gender. But one of the things I liked about the women's game is that we got to know the players. They were there 3 years, 4 years. Do you foresee the women's game changing? Are we going to look back a decade from now and go, hey, those were sweet times when they stayed in school for all 4 years and they generally stayed at one university? Or do you think, what do you think happens here?
man, I think what everybody's been doing is watching, you know, old games. You know, Cole has an old Tiger Woods tournament on all day long at our house. And I love Tiger Woods and I'm sick of it. but it seems like it's just retro times, right? So Saturday we watched 85 national title game, Villanova, Georgetown, you know, and I think people have watched the 30 for 30. The Jimmy V one was so good because it took us right back to the golden era of men's basketball, what it seemed like to me anyway, in my lifetime. And we knew the players. Like, it was unbelievable basketball, and we knew every player. We watched them grow. And then I grew up in Portland. So I remember I loved Dave Twardzik that played with Bill Walton. I loved him. I used to do, like, Dave Twardzik moves back in the day because he was a Blazer, and Larry Steele was here forever, and then it turned into the Drexler era, and Clyde Drexler was Mr. Blazer, and then how much it hurt to see him in a different uniform. And, like, I can't even imagine, like, Terry Porter, my favorite Blazer ever, and I couldn't stand to see him wearing that Spurs uniform. Ah, it just didn't look right.
Yeah.
You know, well, now, if a guy jumps an NBA team, it's like, okay. Now, and you'd be like, the next year, you'd be like, did he play for us? You know,
right.
I mean, he was a Blazer. Oh, yeah, he was on the team last year. And that's what the NBA has become in some ways. You know, obviously, thank the Lord for guys like Lillard, you know, that stick it out, and CJ and guys like him. Well, and hopefully they do for a long time. So in men's basketball, that's happened, you know, to where it's hard to know the guys in some programs. And for our sport, I'm 100% with you. I think the power of our sport is relationships. And it's our fan base knowing these kids for 4 years. And there's so much, it creates a home. It creates, it's like your college home. It's so powerful. And just thinking back to the great Ralph Miller teams and thinking back to our Final Four teams, those kids, I mean, and thinking back to our every player we have. I mean, our fans come because they love these young women because they've been a part of the journey with them and they've watched them grow up. So I'm with you. I hope it doesn't change. My hunch is it's going to change to an uncomfortable level. I don't want it to, though.
Scott Ruick with us, Oregon State women's basketball coach. You know, we are wondering if college football is going to happen. I'm sure you're kind of watching the forecasts for the college basketball season. How did it change recruiting, the ability to scout players? You know, your season, postseason got interrupted. How much high school basketball scouting now? How challenging is it?
I'm back to D3. That is, it's so funny. And in so many ways, it's so comfortable for me because that's what I did for 14 years. I couldn't try. I had a $1,500 recruiting budget. I saw their new coach out in Denver last year recruiting. I'm like, well, they obviously increased their recruiting budget at Fox because I never could get that far from home. And so what I did was I talked on the phone. Obviously we didn't have FaceTime, but you know, I talked on the phone and we couldn't have them come. We couldn't have them go. So the conversations were so intentional and impactful. And so in many ways, I've done this before, you know, but it is different. We're reliant on video at the moment more, or we will be for sure if we can't get out in July. So this recruiting class, these seniors to be, are in a really unique spot, you know, in the fact that their coaches might not be able to see them. And so what can a coach, you know, is there pressure created because of that? Or, I mean, it's a bit of an unknown, but for me, the communication I've enjoyed, and, you know, certainly we all hope it gets back to normal sooner than later. But ironically, you know, I've been here before.
Yeah. And is there an advantage there, or how much, I guess the question is, how much do you need to see, you know, 'cause how much do you need to see, or what else are you looking for that you wouldn't have got?
Well, I think all the intangibles. You know, you can see all the intangibles. It's kind of like a Zoom call. You know, if you do a Zoom call or a meeting, you can't read the room. You know, you're looking at faces on a screen. You don't know what's going on in that room. To do a home visit, you know, a home visit, we got cut off halfway through them. Well, when you sit in a house, you truly get to know people because you're reading the room. You know where the conversation needs to go. Just your emotional intelligence kicks in. And, you know, on looking at a screen, a little square, you can't read those things. It's the same when you're watching film. You know, I'm watching film. I mean, all those years taught me and trained me to be very efficient watching film. I know what to look for and I know what works with me. And I can usually be correct. You know, I've learned that. I had to. But you don't get to see the intangibles necessarily, how they act on the bench, how they interact with an official off the, you know, at the other end of the floor, and how they interact with their coach, or when the possession goes down here and they get pulled out of the game, how do they handle that? What are their parents like in the stands? What are, you know, I mean, all the things that you put into the equation to evaluate, or many of those things are gone, you know, when you're not on site together. And so there's a little bit more gambling, but not really. I think you can make up for those things in questioning and conversation. So I think that's probably what's missing.
Tom Brady leaves the Patriots, goes to Tampa, you know, and he just said he knew it was time to go. I know you pay attention to other sports. Are you not fascinated to see what happens with Bill Belichick and Brady? And, you know, were they both geniuses, or does it just work because they were together? As a coach, how much are you paying attention to that kind of stuff?
I love this. This is awesome. You're asking me about football, and yes, this is a dream. Yes, I'm fascinated by it. And, you know, I'm on the side of the coach. You know, that's not that I align with him, but I understand how important organization is and how important the leadership is, you know, from the top down, and how then absolutely vital talent is. And so I don't know if anybody can even predict that, you know, because I think together there was just magic between those two guys. They understood each other. They both wanted to win at the highest level. And I think when you put two people together that can coexist like that for that long, certainly they've been through their wars, you know, who knows how much they liked each other or hated each other. Who knows? That's all TMZ stuff, you know. But the bottom line is there was a level of trust between those two guys on the field that is nearly unprecedented, to last that long and have that level of success. And so can either of them build that level of trust again in a short period of time? No way. And because of that, it's going to depend on so many other things. But I don't know. It's going to be fascinating to watch. I know that. And I hope we get the chance, you know, to evaluate it.
You hit on something there that I'm curious about, because that dynamic, we always hear about teams that are close and then things get said like, oh, they all hang out together away from the court or whatever. I've always been curious, how close do they need to be? Is it that close, or is it a single-mindedness that they can have? And maybe they aren't that close, but they all understand their roles and they come together and they like each other as teammates, but maybe they don't love each other off the court. How much of that needs to gel, in your opinion?
Yeah. Well, I work like crazy to create that perfect environment. I mean, we work so hard in recruiting to recruit people that will come in and be a great teammate in the locker room, at the same time have the edge, you know, to step between the lines and want to absolutely throttle whoever they're playing. And, you know, it's a fine line, and it's not easy to find, you know, somebody or a team full of people that can turn it on and off, you know, be sisters off the court and killers on it. And so I think that's an ideal scenario. That's what I try to create, is a cohesive room. And what I mean by that is a level of maturity that can problem solve and communicate and stay on the same page, because no group is ever going to be perfect. And every group can go haywire, every group. I don't care who you have. And so if you have those common threads of, we are here to win, we're here to do whatever it takes to get it done together, and we have to stay on the same page and have the maturity to do it, I don't think you have to be super tight. I just think you have to have those common threads. We're in this together. We got each other's back on the field, on the court. And then we have to have leadership that has courage. And, you know, I mean, that's the quality right now in life that probably is the most important. And we all have to be courageous right now. We all have to be tough. Well, who has the courage to step into the void and say, this needs to be done right now? And we have to deal with this right now. And you two have to figure this out, or you have to step up right now. Great teams have that. And when those things are being dealt with, then, I mean, the sky's the limit for your group, you know. And I know that that's what Tom Brady brought to New England. You know, that's what Belichick had. So he empowered his head coach, you know, by being courageous, staying with him, having his back in the key ways. And, you know, because of that, people are always they'll align, you know, for the most part. And the people that won't, you got to go.
In The Greatest Showman, when, you know, he couldn't give her the ballet shoes or the birthday present she wanted, and he was on the rooftop, he just made something that was creative, and the kid loved it. And then later he gives her the ballet shoes. That just crushed me. It was like he remembered, you know. I appreciate that you love that movie. Scott Ruick, appreciate you. Thank you for coming on. Wish you the best. Enjoy that family.
Mutual, John. Yeah, great to talk to you as always, and wish everybody the best. Health and courage out there. Take care of each other.
Scott Ruick, Oregon State women's basketball coach. Punch It Audio is coming up. Leave it here. John Wilner of the San Jose Mercury News wrote a piece this morning in which he suggested that the Pac-12 network could solve its football problem by putting Bill Walton in the broadcast booth for football games. I like Bill Walton. We had him on the show last week. He was great and well-received. And I put on Oregon Live this morning, Bill Walton had sent me his book list, like Bill Walton's turned into Oprah Winfrey, and he's got his list of books, and he also sent his movie list. I put his movie list online first. The book list I'll do later in the week, because I think there are some people out there that are cringing a little bit, trying to find what they should be watching. What I was struck by when I put Bill Walton's list of his 35 favorite movies of all time was how different it would have been from my list of my 35 favorite movies of all time. Like, literally going through his list, and he sent his list to me in a Word document. I had to go through and Google a lot of them because I had not heard of them, didn't know what they were about, and ultimately found out that Bill didn't even have the title of the movie right in a lot of cases. His 35 favorite movies of all time. Are you guys ready to hear some of this? Judah Newby, Alabama Adriana?
Yeah, I can't wait for this.
Yes.
Okay. It's, first of all, it's very heavy on documentaries. He likes documentaries. He also has a very eclectic taste in music. He likes nonfiction. He likes interviews. But there's a couple surprises on the movie list, including one dramatic comedy that I had not seen. And then I looked up and it had like a rating on Rotten Tomatoes of like 11. So here's what he likes. I won't give all 35, but he liked The Irishman, which I haven't seen yet. Robert De Niro, Martin Scorsese. And by the way, he likes Martin Scorsese films. The Irishman, one of like four films on there that are directed by Scorsese. So he likes The Irishman. Have you guys seen The Irishman, either one of you?
I have not, no.
Haven't seen it either.
Would it surprise you that I have not?
Yeah, no, it doesn't surprise me. 20 Feet from Stardom is a really cool movie. I've seen this. This was one of the few movies that he had on his list that I had seen and really liked. 20 Feet from Stardom is like the untold story of backup singers in like major, like you go and you look at major music productions that have like a star, like Taylor Swift or Lady Gaga or, you know, Bruce Springsteen. It's the story of the backup singers that are 20 feet away from the main mic. And sort of their story of trying to break through in the industry. It's a really good one. He had on the list the Bill Murray stories, which is life lessons learned from a mystical man. He's basically out there trying to chase Bigfoot and all these urban legends. I have not seen it. He had a bunch of Ken Burns documentaries, National Parks, The Roosevelts, Prohibition, all by Ken Burns, who, by the way, I need to get back on the show. He had Free Solo on his list. You guys seen Free Solo, the rock climbing, the free climber?
Is that the dude that did Alex Capitan?
Alex Honnold is his name. Yeah,
that's wild.
So he had that one on there, Free Solo. He had another one called The Dawn Wall. It's about rock climbers in Yosemite who, like, climb the face of Half Dome and all that, but they're not free climbing, so they kind of, it's lost. He had a John Lennon Yoko Ono documentary. He had The King's Speech, which I have seen. Colin Firth movie, King's Speech, was on there. He had David Letterman's series on Netflix called My Guest Needs No Introduction. He had The Big Interview with Dan Rather, so a couple of interview things on there. He has a Woodstock documentary called 3 Days That Defined a Generation. That did not surprise me.
I think I've seen that.
You have? Any good?
Yeah, I think if it's the same one I'm thinking of, it's really good.
I like it that as soon as we got into the bohemian section of Bill Walton's list, Adriana was like, okay, now we're talking. Amadeus is on his list. I would not have put Amadeus on there, the biographical drama that shows like Mozart's life. He had the biography of Beethoven on there.
There's no pressure on whoever wrote the soundtrack for those, right?
Right. he has he's groovy. So he has on like movies like Icarus, which is a Netflix documentary about doping and sports. It's really good. I've seen it. It's good. He has on The Long Strange Trip, The Untold Story of the Grateful Dead is on his list.
I thought that was going to be The Longest Yard. That's not on there.
Yeah, but you pretty much have the gist of his list there. Inside Bill Gates' Brain, the history of Bill Gates is on his list. But it's just interesting to me to see his taste. Clarence Clemons, who was the saxophonist for Bruce Springsteen, has a documentary about his life called Who Do I Think I Am? What struck me about the Clarence Clemons entry was that Bill Walton had it as Clarence Clements. And I had to search really hard to find out, like, there's no Clarence Clements. Who are we talking about here? And I finally messaged him, and he was talking about Springsteen's saxophonist. And I'm like, you got his name wrong. But ultimately, your takeaways from his list. How much of Bill Walton's list of the 35 movies of all time should a person be interested in absorbing? Because I don't think you do all 35. You might turn into Bill Walton.
Yeah, that's it's eccentric, but it's also consistent with, I think, Bill's personality.
Yes.
He likes to learn from inspiring people, and that's always staying a student is a great quality to have in this life, and he has that quality. And he just keeps learning from people that left a legacy and were successful. And I think that's great.
I asked Scott Ruick what would be on his list of favorite movies of all time. Judah Newby, Alabama Adriana. You don't have to give me your whole list, but what are we talking about here? Your favorite movies of all time.
I actually went back this weekend and rewatched Parasite, and I think that is up there just for so many different reasons. The cinematography of it, it's shot so well. The storyline is great. It keeps you hooked. And then other than that, just because it's like the most recent one that I watched, I'd have to kind of go back and think about it.
I look back. Go ahead, Jody, you first.
Well, I mean, you know, similar to Bill, I'd probably have a little variety, though. Like, The Sandlot is, like, my favorite childhood baseball
yeah,
movie.
Yeah, that's not showing up on Bill Walton's list.
Right?
What else? Here's the other thing that showed up on Bill Walton's list that surprised me. There's a drama romance called Life Itself. Either one of you guys seen this movie?
I have not, no.
It did not fit on the list. It was Oscar Wilde, Olivia Wilde, Annette Bening. New York City couple that goes from a college romance to marriage and the birth of their first child. And it's kind of like, their life as it happens. And I saw, like, it, you know, on IMDb, it got 6 out of 10. On Rotten Tomatoes, it had like an 11% approval rating. It was, and I looked and I was like, "Life, why is this on here?" Like, it was almost like he liked the title of it. I don't know if he'd seen it or not, but that did not fit. What movie would you have on your list that people would just not understand? Because my list, I go with powerhouse movies like Shawshank Redemption, yeah. Silence of the Lambs. I would put Citizen Kane, Orson Welles on my, like, if I had a list of you know, my top 30. But then I do have some weird movies. Like, I love the movie Murder by Death. And if you haven't seen Murder by Death, I want you to queue it up on Netflix or whatever you queue it up on. It's like mid to late 1970s. You're talking about Peter Falk, Peter Sellers, Truman Capote in that movie. But Rotten Tomatoes says it's a 63. I think it's like a 93. But, you know, I look back and I go, it's a comedy that's disguised as a murder mystery. What would be on your list that people would laugh at?
I think for me, like, my favorite Will Ferrell movie is Stranger Than Fiction, not like his comedy stuff. And I think that's got so many redeeming qualities and storylines in it.
I think for me, because growing up, my sister and I shared a room and we had this tiny TV with a little VHS thing in it. And so we had all these movies that we would just watch over and over on VHS. And one of them was like Happy Gilmore.
Yes.
So that to me is just like a classic. And then also Bring It On, the cheer movie. Those two just like always remind me of that old TV that we have.
The movie Memento, I really enjoyed. I've known other people who hate the movie. That movie I liked because I love the idea of waking up every day and you can't remember and he's taking a bunch of Polaroids. He's got tattoos all over himself to remind himself of stuff. It's, you know, it's a little bit of a psychological thrill.
We interrupt this broadcast with a special announcement from the Bald-Faced Truth.
Hey, sorry to interrupt the podcast, but if you want to listen to more of the Bald-Faced Truth radio show, including more of this segment that you're listening to, make sure you subscribe on SoundCloud and iTunes to the Bald-Faced Truth radio show. Thanks for listening.